This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
This is Chicago's all-news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBBM News Time, 12:03. It's great to have you with us for the Tuesday edition of the Noon Business Hour. I'm Cisco Cotto. Beautiful day on tap. In fact, a beautiful week is in store. Today, sunshine, no rain in the forecast, heading to a high of 78 degrees. And we are just about there, 75 right now at O'Hare, 77 Midway, and 75 along Chicago's lakefront. The Noon Business Hour is presented by the Village of Bedford Park. Oil and gas prices, have they stabilized? Will they go higher? Also, Travel Tuesday today. Pulling the kids out of school, is it worth it for a trip? An information breach at a major credit card company is putting more than 100 million customers at risk. We will cover that in our next segment. Right now, though, trade talks with China have resumed. The Fed is beginning a two-day meeting on interest rates. Let's talk about that and a key data point out today. Paul Christopher, head of global market strategy at Wells Fargo Investment Institute, based in St. Louis. Paul, obviously, trade talks resuming seems on its face like a good thing, but are we expecting any breakthroughs anytime soon?
Right, that's the main question, Cisco, and people are also watching to see whether those tariffs applied in May will have some impact soon and how large that will be. Of course, the trade talks themselves are getting started after a hiatus, and the president is shooting a broadside of China's way. You know, the Chinese have been promising to buy more goods from the United States. The president expects them to do so, but the Chinese have also made it quite clear that they're tying those future additional purchases to concessions from the U.S., especially in terms of technology transfer that the U.S. has threatened to shut down. So it remains to be seen how they are going to sort out those two issues.
I'm wondering, the longer that this goes on, with trade talks with no resolution, the closer we get to a 2020 election, it does make you wonder if the Chinese could wait this out, just seeing if we have a new president or if they'll have to deal with President Trump for another 4 years.
Yeah, it's a good point. We think both sides actually want to drag this out into 2020. It won't take that much effort either, because there's so many difficult issues for them to solve. Yes, the Chinese want to wait to see what their chances are of maybe getting a different president in the White House to negotiate with, but the president, President Trump himself, also probably wants to wait into 2020, maybe to get closer to the election and then conclude a deal with the Chinese so that that good news, that success is fresh in voters' minds when they go to the polls next November.
Let's talk about a data point today. Pending home sales beating expectations. Do the lower interest rates have anything to do with this?
Not much. The home sales are probably more closely tied to what goes on with the 10-year Treasury yield, mainly because home buyers these days are going for fixed rate mortgages to lock in those low rates for longer. The adjustable rate mortgages that would move more with the changes in the Fed's rate, those are less popular these days.
Consumer confidence, another data point, it is higher. How important is that? It seems like confident consumers are spending consumers.
Absolutely. And the consumer has been the main driver of this recovery since 2009, remains so. The labor market is good. Wages are rising just enough to outpace inflation. So it's giving consumers some real purchasing power gains every month and every year. We think we need that consumer spending to continue to push the economy forward.
Thanks for the insight. Always good to have you on the show. Paul Christopher, head of global market strategy at Wells Fargo Investment Institute. Still ahead in just moments, Capital One deals with a huge hack of customer information. A hack believed to be committed by a former software engineer for Amazon is impacting credit card giant Capital One. Let's get the latest and also some advice for consumers. Jerry Irvine is joining us, CIO of Prescient Solutions, member of the National Cybersecurity Task Force here in Chicago. Jerry, so give us what you have, nuts and bolts, about this hack here. Seems like a lot of people are impacted.
Yeah, you know, fortunately and both unfortunately, the bulk of the hack was contact information, names, addresses, things of that nature, with only about 140,000 Social Security numbers from the United States and about a million from Canada, and very few bank card information. But you know what? The Social Security numbers are actually more dangerous than the bank card, because hackers can use that to create new fraudulent credit cards or loan accounts. So you really have to be careful and understand what these potential risks are for yourselves.
Have you found that consumers are pretty much numb to this stuff now? I mean, it seems like every week there's another huge data breach.
Absolutely. And you know, people just are kind of at a point, well, they're going to get me if they're going to get me. There are a lot of things that you can do to protect yourself. Obviously, you know, get yourselves one of these identity and credit monitoring companies. A lot of that is being provided now by, you know, your insurance or bank cards and things of that nature. But make sure you have that and are looking at it. The other thing you can do is go to the credit organizations, the credit rating organizations, and actually turn off your credit or lock your credit. This keeps hackers or anybody who's unauthorized from being able to open a new credit card account for you or any type of loan account, even new phones or things of that nature. So that will allow you to live a little bit easier. And then when you are going in for a loan, you just give them a call and turn it back on and go from it for there.
Now talk, Jerry, about what happens if your identity is stolen. I think a lot of the people who just sort of ignore this stuff because it happens all the time are not those who've had their identity stolen and have had to deal with all of that mess.
Oh, it can take 2 to 3 years to get everything straightened out. And sometimes, you know, it even takes longer. So the main problem with this is now, as soon as it happens in one account, hackers get that information and start using it on everything. So in addition to turning off your bank account, now you have to go to the creditors and explain to them that you didn't make the purchases. You have to have somebody, hopefully you have the protection on your credit card or something, to deny the claim. But if you're going through a large purchase or some type of loan at that time, it can keep you from being able to, you know, buy a house, buy a car, do any type of new loans. So it's very important that you protect yourself.
Thanks so much, Jerry Irvine, CIO of Prescient Solutions, also a member of the National Cybersecurity Task Force, talking about that Capital One data breach. More than 100 million customers are impacted. Up next, the Chicago job market is hot these days. We will tell you what industries, what areas, and exactly where in the city.
Making sense of your dollars. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Fresh federal data indicates the employment in the Chicago metropolitan area is growing faster than the national rate. We welcome Greg Hines, columnist at Crain's Chicago Business. Greg, I guess is pretty good news for people either looking for a job or maybe people who want a better job.
Yeah, as Cisco it is. I guess if you're going to be a card-carrying member of the Chicago media, most of the time you can only write that we're going to hell in a handbasket and things are terrible. But the employment front, actually, the news is the best it's been for a while. The state, according to the latest data, gained almost 100,000 jobs in the last year, which is the best it's been in several years. And the metropolitan area, which had been lagging the national rate, has bumped ahead for the last year. It's now added 1.8%, which is more than 1.5% national growth. That doesn't mean we're on the way to nirvana, but it's a lot better than it had been.
And it means that, I guess, some of it is, you mentioned those dire predictions about, you know, pensions, debt and taxes and all of that, that if you have a good job and if companies are willing to put you here, that there's people willing to come here, people willing to move here to work.
Well, we'll find out if they're going to move. Most of these jobs presumably have been filled by people that are here. But it does indicate that while there are certainly enormous fiscal problems, and that while that is an overhang on things, that there seems to be some evidence that at least amidst this national economic recovery we've had, that we are finally getting our fair share. It may be that there are some economists who say that because of the nature of our economy, we always enter recessions later than the rest of the country, but we come out of them later, and maybe that we're replicating that. You know, we'll have to see how this plays out with more data to come, but it certainly makes you feel a little better than you did before.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's nice to have some good news, that's for sure. Is the data, maybe we have to wait for this, the data showing whether these are good jobs or whether they're jobs on the lower end of the wage scale, or maybe we're just not there yet?
I didn't have access to the wage information, but it appears to be kind of spread out. A lot in educational services and health services, a lot in business and professional services, a lot in the hospitality industry. That suggests that it's a little mix of both. That there's some stuff that's not too high above the minimum wage, the hospitality industry, but when you get into health and educational services, those generally are pretty well paid jobs.
Are we able to tell yet whether this is a statewide or is it just Chicago? I know a lot of the downstate communities are talking about how much they're hurting.
There is some evidence that downstate is finally starting to join in the party, too. Downstate actually is more dependent on manufacturing than Chicago is now, believe it or not, by how things change. But some of those cities have finally shown some year-to-year gains for the first time in a while. We'll see how far that goes, but that is a change. Those kind of mid-level industrial towns, places all like Rockford and Decatur and whatever, they've had some rough times. In the middle now, things appear to be somewhat less rough.
I'm guessing that credit rating agencies pay attention to this. They like more taxpayers paying into the system.
They do, and they like higher tax rates, which we certainly have here. But the credit rating agencies are not going to be happy until we solve our pension plan. We're talking, what, $140 billion unfunded liabilities at the state level, 20-something billion at the city level. Until we solve that, the credit rating agencies are not going to send us a bottle of champagne.
Well, we'll have you back next week, and you and I will get this all solved, okay?
There you go. It's the deal.
All right. Greg Hines, always appreciate you being on the show. Greg Hines, columnist at Crain's Chicago Business. Still ahead, Travel Tuesday. Is it wise to take kids out of school for a family trip?
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Cisco Cotto. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. The best time for a family trip could be once kids are back in school. We'll talk about the possibilities in Travel Tuesday. Oil is higher today. We'll look at where the market may be heading longer term. The Chicago Inspector General says the police department is not making the best use of officer body cameras. President Trump says he's the least racist person out there anywhere in the world. On Wall Street, the Dow down 59, NASDAQ down 26, and the S&P down 10 points. Oil up right about 1%. Beautiful sunshine all day long, heading to a high of 78. That's basically where we are now. 75 O'Hare, 77 Midway, also 75 degrees along Chicago's lakefront. The Noon Business Hour is presented by the Village of Bedford Park. Markets are in the red today, just slightly. Let's talk about it with Michael Palumbo, founder of MJP Capital, author of the book Calculated Risk, based here in Chicago. Mike, thanks for being with us. What do you make of what you're seeing on Wall Street today?
Well, good afternoon, Cisco, and thanks for having me on again. You know, I think this is just a little bit of a respite before the Fed meeting results tomorrow and before Apple earnings after the close today. We've come a long way. We got the S&P above 3,000, which basically is within striking distance of all-time highs. In my mind, that's a little bit pricey. I've said that as we got to 3,000 that investors should trim their longs here. But, you know, we've hung in there, and, I think the market now is looking towards the Fed move tomorrow.
Interesting that you say that, because a lot of investors just simply want the market to go higher, 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 regardless of the underlying fundamentals. So, I mean, you're saying as good investors over the long run, it's okay to want things to dip a little bit sometimes.
Well, the dips are at least the U.S. markets have always been buying opportunities, whether it's over the span of a few months or sometimes it takes a few years, but you know every dip has been a buying opportunity. Will that always be the case forever? Not, no, but that's been the case here. The United States has been the best place to put your capital since World War II, without a doubt. So, yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with having a little bit of a dip here. We had one in fourth quarter, and I advocated that it was a massive buying opportunity, and we were right about that. Up here, I just think we're really stretched valuation-wise. And even if the Fed does what we think it will do, which will lower by a quarter point, I don't see that being a catalyst for a large move higher here. I think that, if anything, maybe we tread water at best, and we might sell off just a touch.
I'm wondering if you think that that the widespread use of ETFs, is it all having an impact on valuation, or will? And here's what I mean by that. If you have a broad-based ETF where it's really easy and really cheap for someone just to dump money into it, is that going to artificially maybe inflate some other stocks that wouldn't necessarily be inflated?
Well, you know, with the ETF, then it's going to raise the whole sector, so it would be fairly indiscriminate. So you may get some stocks benefiting from it when they don't deserve it. But overall, I think ETFs are great because it allows people to, you know, they can invest in entire industries as opposed to 10, 15 years ago when you had to pick individual stocks or do the work yourself by allocating funds across a wide variety of stocks. So the net there is that it's a very good positive, but certainly you can have a few stocks within an ETF that maybe are benefiting from the ETF maybe more so than they should.
Yeah, remember those old days when you had to do research, Mike?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You still should be doing research, right? But yeah, it definitely has made it easier that if you have a overall thesis on an industry, you can then just play that out as opposed to worrying about picking a stock. And in a way, that's great because let's say you like industrials. Well, you know, you may pick the wrong one as opposed to if you pick the ETF and you're right about the sector, then you're going to win. And so I think it's good overall. But, yes, certainly it does kind of dumb down a little bit some of the work you need to do to pick stocks.
Let's talk about Apple. They're going to release results today after the bell. What are investors looking for as Apple reports?
Well, they're looking for a lackluster number. I think the expected earnings is $2.10 average consensus on $33 billion of revenue. That's actually down from last year, same quarter. So they're actually expecting earnings to be slightly down. But the stock has hung in there pretty well because this is looked at as just a temporary blip. But I'll tell you, Apple has gone from a growth stock from 5-10 years ago to more of a value stock. You know, its earnings are only expected to grow 5-10% over the next year to two. So really, now it's trading at about a 16 PE. That's certainly not a growth stock number. So Apple, and you see Warren Buffett getting involved in Apple, so a lot of growth, a lot of value investors are now looking at Apple differently than they did a while ago because they're now a mature company that is not expected to grow quickly, but just expected to maintain its monopoly position in phones. It will be interesting when the earnings come out this afternoon what they talk about in China and what they expect for future numbers, because I think the number this quarter will be fairly irrelevant, and it'll be really what management talks about going forward.
So if Apple is really no longer a growth stock, are they going to have to look even more toward dividends in order to make the stock attractive?
I think they'll definitely continue to raise dividends. What else they can do with all their cash? I mean, they might still buy back some stock, too. But, yeah, the dividends should continue to grow. And that's, again, like you'd said, that will make it more of a value stock. And the type of investor that looks at Apple will be different than it was 10 years ago. Doesn't mean it's not a good stock. I just think it's 16 PE with no growth. It's fully valued for sure. I think that if you get a bump up in earning in the stock price tomorrow, it'll be just because of management commentary that might surprise the upside on what they predict for next year. They're predicting right now 5-7% earnings growth. Maybe they say it's a little bit higher. If that's the case, it might bump the stock a little bit. I just would expect this will be a fairly low volatility earnings event for Apple, something like a 3 to 5% price move either way. It's not going to be a crazy move, I would expect anyway.
Michael Palumbo, founder of MJP Capital, author of the book Calculated Risk. Up next, Travel Tuesday, deciding if it's smart to take kids out of school for a vacation.
A deposit for your future. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Travel Tuesday on the Noon Business Hour, sponsored by Hamilton County Tourism. This afternoon, we're discussing the merits of a family trip at a time when kids are usually in school. We welcome Cindy Richards, editor-in-chief of TravelingMom.com, based here in Chicago. Cindy, so what we're talking about is instead of traveling, say, during August when everyone is traveling, maybe postponing a couple of weeks, taking the kids out of school and traveling then?
Well, there are huge advantages to doing that. It's generally cheaper, right? Shoulder season, they call it shoulder season travel. And, you know, airfares will be down. The places that you're going will be less crowded because everybody's back in school, right? So you'll get more for your money when you arrive.
And an opportunity to maybe give kids some experiences, educational, that they wouldn't necessarily get in school, obviously, if they're traveling.
Well, you know, there are a lot of different schools of thought about taking kids out of school to travel. I did it all the time with my kids. And there were a lot of benefits to that. For example, you know, when they started studying Mayan history, they'd already been to Mexico and been to the ruins at Tulum. And, you know, so they had sort of a real life way to think about what they were learning in school. You know, some people think, you need to take them to Colonial Williamsburg and they'll learn history. But I'm a believer that any kind of travel is educational. You know, you can take them to Disney and make it educational. You can make them figure out the math of how long they're going to have to wait in line. If they're little kids, they actually learn the skill of waiting in line at Disney because that's what you do at Disney a lot, right?
Yeah, so it doesn't necessarily I mean, it can be educational, it can be fun, but you're making memories with the kids and you're doing it at an affordable price.
Absolutely. And, and nobody can discount the value of family bonding, right? So during a family vacation, you're spending that uninterrupted time together, and that's always, you know, priceless.
What do you say to all of the teachers that are listening right now and cringing at the thought of students being taken out of school for travel?
Well, you know, I've talked to a lot of teachers about this. I've written stories on TravelingMom.com about taking your kids out of school to travel, and I always hear from teachers. And there are a couple of things that really tend to ring true. The biggest complaint I get from teachers is, you know, the parents come to me and they want me to give them all the homework that the kid would have missed while they were gone next week. So I think you should always talk to teachers about it. And you have to bear in mind, school districts are really cracking down on this because their money is tied to attendance. So you should find out the rules of your school district and you should talk to the teachers. But I say, don't ask them for the homework ahead of time, because that's just more work on the teacher to figure out everything your kid's going to miss. Just tell them, you know what, we'll make up whatever he missed when we get back.
Yeah, it makes sense. That's probably easier for everyone. Yeah, thank you. Cindy Richards, editor-in-chief of TravelingMom.com, joining us on Travel Tuesday. This time tomorrow, Personal Finance Wednesday. Still to come today, an update on the gas and oil market. They're being stubborn and actually now today moving a little higher, though.
Conversation that's on the money. You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Pump prices for gas are at a four-month low. Let's talk about what's happening in the oil and gasoline market. Phil Flynn, senior market analyst at Price Group, also a Fox Business Network contributor. Phil, we were up well above $60 a barrel, and now it's gone back down, and it seems to stubbornly want to stay below $60.
It does. It really does. But I'll tell you what. Right now, this rally that we're seeing in oil may signal that prices are not going to go down that much lower. And that might be because we are seeing very strong consumer confidence, which usually bodes very well for oil demand, because when people are feeling good, they spend money, they drive, they use a lot of oil. And also, of course, the Federal Reserve lowering interest rates, because almost every time that happens, when the Fed cuts rates, the demand for oil goes up because it spurs a lot of economic activity.
And so is there a way, I mean, obviously, if you could predict oil, you'd be wealthy. But is there a way to sort of figure out what's on the horizon and whether this will be sustained?
I think you don't want to fight the Fed. I mean, if the Fed is telling you that they want the stock market to go higher, they want to spur inflation, that generally means that oil prices should go higher. And listen, you know, we've seen prices come down from the highs because, you know, there's a sense that the imminent threat of a conflict with Iran has cooled down a bit, and so those prices came back down. But what we have found is that when those prices come down, the demand for oil goes up. And when gasoline prices go down, consumers love it, and they start to drive more, and we start this beautiful, strong economic oil cycle all over again.
And talk about the importance. I mean, when people think about oil, they simply think about gasoline, but it really impacts every area of the economy, and I mean, it's everything that we see going on in oil markets is really huge for the economy.
Yeah, I call it the lifeblood of the economy. You know, if you could poke the economy, it would bleed oil, right? In fact, I always tell people I like to wear my oil to work every day because, you know, I'm wearing my oil-based gym shoes. I'm wearing oil-based shoes. I mean, so many of the things that we don't think about are impacted by oil. But even, you know, every good that you buy is transported more than likely by oil, either by trains or planes or automobiles. And so when we see these prices go up and down, it does have a trickle-down effect or a trickle-up effect across the entire economy.
Then you also have, obviously, people paying less for gas. That's money that is not necessarily the difference in what they're paying is not necessarily sitting in their bank account. It's probably getting spent in other areas of the economy.
It generally does, especially when consumers are confident, right? And if prices come down at the gas tank and they go in and they fill up and they give them their $50 and there's money left over, they might say, hey, you know what, you know, give me one of those Slurpees or give me put that money to work. And generally we do see that in a strong economy. But I'll tell you this, you know, when I look at the Chicago average and I look at the rest of the country, we're still well above the rest of the country. I mean, our national average is $2.99 a gallon, and, you know, the national average is $2.72. So even though we feel better that it's down, it's still a lot higher than it is in other places. And if you miss paying $4 a gallon for a gallon, you still have a chance. There's one station in Chicago that will sell you gas for over $4 a gallon. So you better hurry up. You might not get that chance too much longer.
Yeah. Right now you're causing traffic jams now, Phil, with people heading to that gas station. Thanks for being with us. Appreciate the insight. Phil Flynn, Senior Market Analyst at the Price Group.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly!